With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
In our cultures, Asian women want to get old because most of them suffer horribly through their teen years, often with through marriages. You know, the mothers-in-law are awful to them often. They are powerless. But once they hit that age of 40, they become matriarchs and they become powerful. So they all want to get old before their time.
Is that remarkable?
So interesting.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humour with you. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business success and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is a multi-award-winning journalist and author. She was the first regular columnist of colour on a national newspaper in the UK. The first female Muslim, too. She has written for The Guardian, The Observer, The New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, The Evening Standard, The Mail, and was a weekly columnist on The Independent for 18 years. She now writes a weekly column for the I newspaper. Self-described as a lefty, liberal, anti-racist, feminist Muslim person, her work is highly regarded for its stance on immigration, race, diversity, and multiculturalism. Her political pieces are pointed and punchy, and her books bring a new light to the British Empire in a world where multiculturalism is here to stay. When she's not writing captivating coverage of the country filled with inspiring and amusing insights, you can catch her as a regular on BBC's Any Questions and The Jeremy Vine Show, plus Channel 4 News. Yasmin Alabaya-Brown, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
Good to be here, Paul.
Well, it's lovely to have you. Now, you grew up in Kampala in Uganda under the rule of Idi Amin in what was a very divided society. Was there much humour around it? If so, how did it manifest itself?
Humour is what got the people of that country through some of the most, well, a really tragic history, really. You know, they're incredibly benign, gentle folk, Ugandans, the indigenous Ugandans, happy. And merry and always laughing. And when we were divided off from each other because the empire had these racial divisions and class divisions, but laughter brought us together. And I had a very dear friend called Sophie, who was the funniest woman I ever knew. She was black. She lost her husband, her father, to the violence in the country, to the political violence. Three siblings to AIDS, a daughter to AIDS, and a son was stabbed to death here, by his girlfriend. And she laughed. And last year I lost her. And I just used to say to her, how are you like this? She said, what else is there? If we don't laugh, we die.
It's so true. And it's I suppose, the one thing that everybody's got left is and under their control is the ability to laugh, because tragedy is going to happen to everyone. And it sounds like your friend had more tragedy than was fair. But wonderful. Was humour valued in your family?
No. I came from a really ugly... my mother was very funny. My mother had a very hard life, incredibly hard life. Bad marriage from day one. My father was 16 years older. He should never have married anyone. Very smart. Not a malevolent man, just quite useless. And it was my mother who raised the three children, and she would talk about her life, and she would kind of giggle and roll with laughter, telling you about how, you know, the first week of marriage, he took her to the cinema, forgot he was married, forgot she was there, went home to bed, left this girl in a cinema, and she would laugh about it. You know, so she was the one who would laugh, but the rest were pretty, my father hardly ever laughed. My brother was very damaged. My sister had her own problem. So it wasn't a fun family, but my mother was fun. And people in the mosque still remember her laughing.
Well, that's so you've taken that from her, have you? I mean, that was what...
Yeah.
I mean, she sounds like an incredibly strong woman to have brought up three children. And one of the things about strength, and the whole Humorology project is built around this, is that strength does come from seeing the funny side.
Yes. And it made her... You know, it kind of made people realize that not only was she strong, but that, you know, she was not going to burden them with make them cry. And in funny way, she evoked more empathy when she told her stories in the way she told them, rather than weep. But she was emotionally so awake. I miss her to this day. We were very close. And, you know, my siblings didn't survive this family. My brother died an alcoholic. My sister died last year of COVID, but she was severely mentally ill. I'm the only survivor. And I'm like my mother.
And do you think that strain of having humor is the thing that actually made you survive?
I mean, I don't think everything should be funny. Let me tell you this story very quickly. So when I became a journalist, which was very late in life, I was 37, and I woke up one morning and became a journalist, literally. I wrote an article. I couldn't type. A week later, it was published in The Guardian. I was just ridiculous. And very soon after that, you know, I had a rapid ladder that I went up. And at one point, an editor of liberal, shall we say, left persuasion, got a bit drunk at a media party. And he kind of lurched over to me and he said, oh, you've really done well. Of course, it was the Brown that made the difference. You wouldn't have got this far with that foreign name, would you? So I looked at him with my glass in my hand and smiled and said, yeah, I know. I was so lucky to find him. But imagine where I'd be if I'd married a Mr. White. And there was a group of people all around us and they just fell about. And that was a lesson in racism he will never forget.
That's a beautiful and the perfect put down. The lovely Jo Brand on the show, and she said that one of her pieces of advice, which I thought was very good, is that women who do get bullied in the workplace or, you know, wolf whistled or anything, should have a few put downs, a few heckle put downs in their back pocket, because they're very useful. And usually those people who are so-called brave back off when actually somebody comes back with something quickly. Do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think either you can do, and I have been angry too. I'm often, you know, when people say appalling stuff to me, I mean, apparently I'm amongst the most abused people on social media. And it's always about, you're an immigrant, you're a Muslim, you're a remainer, go back where you came from. Just go back where you came from. That's the thing. And so I do kind of come back at them quite hard. But sometimes, you know, you can have fun with that. So they'll say, where do you come from? I'd say, you know, West London. No, where do you really come from? I said, yeah, West London. Where do you come from? Oh, Yorkshire. No, but where do you really come from? And the echo, suddenly the penny drops, you know? But but often it's really interesting. People say to me, we didn't know you were funny. And that's interesting, because I think maybe I do come across as too serious too much of the time. So I need to change that.
Well, I think that, because I really wanted you on the show because I'd met you before, and I always found that you were wonderfully funny and light and had a wonderful joie de vivre about you, which I don't think that the public perceived, because no. I think they put everybody in little silos, don't they? That if you are serious about anti-racism, anti-sexism, whatever, you have to be a serious person. But do you think actually having a sense of humor about these things actually is a great tool to actually move the conversation forward?
Yes, and it also makes people feel at ease. So you can sometimes say quite tough things to them if you are not saying them in a desperately serious way. Do you know what I mean? That they might listen a bit more if you kind of say it lightly.
It's easier to say the truth,
it's
isn't
it? With great skill. I mean, Joe Brand is amazing at it. Some of these comedians who, and not just comedians, I wish more politicians, this is what you should do. Teach politicians how to use humor. They're always so dour. I mean, Keir Starmer, oh, lighten up, man.
I hear that in person, he can be light and thing, but it's some people. When they, like when you and I do a lot of conferences, when people at conferences, they go, I must be the boss, I must be clear, and I must have this serious demeanor. And I don't think that people realize that a lightness of touch and a humor actually is a power position as well.
Well, this is how I think Jess Phillips really uses that.
I agree.
She's really witty, she's funny, and she's very powerful for that reason. But yes, I think, I think humor, as long as I'm not one of those who would ever say we can laugh at everything. We can't, because when there's so much pain involved, I wouldn't find COVID jokes aimed at people who've lost family members funny. But it is important to remember that humor is one of the tools you have as a human being. There isn't a group in the world, past or present, where laughter hasn't been the bond, the release, the link between people.
I couldn't agree more. But sometimes humor, when you grew up under the rule of Idi Amin, and he thought he was funny, didn't he? I remember a quote from Idi Amin where he said, there is freedom of speech, but I cannot guarantee freedom after speech. And I'm going, that's really quite uncompromising and horrible, really.
He was very funny. And in a way, we can see the danger of funny politicians charming people. I'm not suggesting our present Prime Minister is Idi Amin, but people see him as funny.
Yes.
And he's used that very effectively. And Idi Amin, I remember once I met Idi Amin.
Did you?
When I was 16 years old. And he was again, he thought he would. So there was this very peculiar thing that happened, but he was the general then. And a group of our student leaders ended up staying with the president for our summer holidays. We were ordered to do this, and we were to meet all the ministers and find out how politics worked. This was during 68 when they were getting worried about student revolts in Europe. And I met Idi Amin, and ever kind of careless, I said, and you know, he was kind of up there and I was down here. And I said, why are there no Asians in the Ugandan army? And he kind of looked down at me and he said, hey, at that laugh from his belly. And he said, because we do not eat choroko. Choroko means lentils. And he said, we Africans eat red blood meat. You are not Africans. That was his reply.
I'm interested to this thing that you say you like Keir Starmer to have more humour, but humour can also be misdirecting, can't it? So people don't see the bad things that lurk underneath.
No, I think what would be nice if Keir Starmer wasn't so buttoned up, allowed himself, you know, to smile, to have some wit, to laugh out loud sometimes. We need to see that side of him. I think that it will, you know, I've met him. In some ways, I respect him, not all, but I just wish he'd let go a little bit because people relate to that. Otherwise, politics becomes too distant, I think.
I absolutely agree. And I just wonder if it is seen now as a weakness that is going to be, you know, that if you do that, you are going to possibly make a faux pas that you can't come back from. And in such a hostile environment where the press and the media will jump on anything, the desperation not to show any weakness just supersedes the real person and the connection. But I completely agree. It's interesting. I was interested because you are such an advocate for feminism, and I heard you in an interview say that women were raised to be liked, and I wondered, do you think that sometimes women perceive that in order to be liked, they need to suppress their own sense of humour?
Yes, there are all these unwritten rules, aren't there? And categories. I remember what a hard time they gave Jo Brand when she first started.
I worked with Jo in those days. Awful. And I love Jo to bits, but I mean, the abuse she was given, not only at the Comedy Store where we worked together, but in the press. It was vitriolic and horrible.
Yes, and over and over again, you find women comedians or even writing for various publications. I've seen how the posse has been attacking Laura Koonsberg. I mean, it's a whole posse. And that's not because, you know, she's done anything wrong, but they just want to get her for a fallen word, a slight pause. And so she's become totally humorless. Before she got this job, she used to do reports. And I remember walking up to her once at a Tory party conference saying, you know, Laura, you're so good at what you do because you're so sparkling and you smile and all this. All that stopped because the posse went after her. So I think, and you see it with Emily Maitlis, you see it with, all these women, they have to be absolutely careful. And laughter, you know, one of the interesting things is the one thing Taliban and ISIS and some of the horrible Saudi-influenced imams in this country say, a woman must not be allowed to laugh too loudly in public. And if she does, she must be stopped. They tell the husbands that the women should not be laughing too loudly. They see the threat of it. Isn't that awful?
It is awful, but it would seem to me that all totalitarian regimes are scared of humour because it can prick the bubble of pomposity. And so they close it down early because they worry that they're going to be humiliated or something.
But this is very specifically targeting the women, saying a woman has to be invisible, has to be silent, has to be obedient, has to be obliging. And laughter is a kind of declaration of freedom, and they don't like it.
But I love
among
laughter.
Among my many rainbow of enemies, there are these Islamicists too, because they say, I'm just not the right kind of woman to be out here.
I think I love the fact that that you've expressed it so beautifully, and it'll probably end up in the book. I'll give you a credit, obviously, but that laughter is an expression of freedom.
Yes,
and I really think that that is, and I also think on a personal level that men's egos get very damaged by funnier women, and that's why I wondered when you said, you know, raised to be liked. And sometimes men want to be the funny one.
Yes.
And the women cocks her head to the side and laughs at the man's
and
jokes.
We must always laugh at their bad jokes and cheer them on, little things. Look, I love men. I've loved men all my life, and men have loved me. Which some of my detractors find quite hard to understand. But one of the things is that there are too many fragile male egos who only see the world in terms of who's up and who's down. The best thing about living in our times is that it's finally, in some parts of the world, possible for us men and women to be equals. There's never been a historical period like this. So the burden, for example, of a man having to be the breadwinner and, you know, raise the money to bring up, that can be shared. And, you know, in my book, Ladies Who Punch, I've quoted my absolute heroine, who's Mary Wollstonecraft, who said, you know, don't kind of perform and be coy and play up to what men want you to be and earn your own living. Because if you don't, both men and women lose their dignity. So I think, you know, it's such a wonderful period we're living through. And yet you look on social media and the way they treat women and the way they describe perfectly harmless women,
it's
quite sad for them, really.
Well, it's a bizarre thing when having a sense of humour and making jokes could be deemed getting above your station.
Because they love the trope. They love the trope of the angry woman, which is how they describe me. And they love the trope of the angry black woman. And anything that makes them question that, and laughter is one way, makes them even more angry. It's really interesting to me.
It is interesting, the psyche that goes, hold on, you're not allowed to be fun or funny. We need to put you in this box. which is the angry woman with the rolling pin.
Exactly, exactly. I remember when I was young. Do you remember Andy Cap?
I do, yes. The cartoon.
Do you remember that was the trope?
Yeah.
A Flo, I think her name was, or something, you know, curlers in her hair, rolling pin in her hand, poor little Andy, put upon. That still persists.
It is strange. You mentioned Ladies Who Punch, which is one of my particular favourites of your books, and I advise everybody to read it. And you highlight 50 courageous women who have changed history and remoulded our culture. I was also intrigued that you chose the women that you didn't particularly like, for instance, Margaret Thatcher, because you felt it was important to be impartial. One of the things that we do with the Humorology Project is that we ignore people's politics. We're impartial to that and just see what we can learn from their humour. Do you think that humour can be a useful bonding tool across the political divide?
Yes, one of my closest friends is Ian Dale, and we couldn't disagree more. He's a Tory. I loathe Tories. He's, a Brexiter. I'm a Remainer, blah, 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 blah. But we make each other laugh. We've been friends for the longest time, and actually, he has done more for me than most other people in my career. And we laugh a lot together. And when I'm on the, and they ask, they do get in touch with it. How can you stand that woman? But, you know, it's really good. We really love, and the reason for having Margaret Thatcher or Penny Mordaunt or and Joan Collins in the book is because my criteria was women who never knew their place. That was my criteria. And these women do not or did not know their place. It wasn't about politics or feminism in the political sense. It was just any woman who said, no, thank you. I'm not going to be exactly what you said. I'm not going to go into that box. I don't want that label. I'm not going to be in my place. And anybody who, I could have done 10 volumes. There are so many women who say no. And some in the nicest and funniest sort of, Shazia Mirza is in the book, the comedian. And she is utterly brilliant, utterly brilliant. Not only because she was, I think, the first stand-up Muslim comedian in this country, but the subjects she takes. She did a whole show on the ISIS brides, for example, who went off, the schoolgirls. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to the show and was full of Muslim, quite traditional-looking Muslims. And she said, well, of course, they went for sex. They went looking for their Tom Cruise. And there was this, oh, my God, what has she just said? And then everybody started laughing, saying, yeah, probably, because living very restricted lives.
Yeah. Well, and actually, but that's the, is the best humour tapping into truth? Because that's a truth that nobody wants to actually think about. This is still a teenage girl with the hormones going crazy.
Yeah, it tapped into a truth nobody was even thinking, let alone saying. And certain, I've just done a whole huge research project where I raised the money myself, and it's called The Inner Lives of Troubled Young Muslims. And they weren't all terrorists. So some, you know, we did look into the mindset of wannabe terrorists. But what is so clear is sexuality is a deep issue that the families and communities just don't want to address. That we want to pretend that we don't think about sex when our hormones are raving, and or that we have no gay people. Gayness is a Western thing. You know, and it's just crazy because there was a time, it's the British who outlawed homosexuality in the Arab lands and India.
Is it?
Did you know that? Until then, homosexuality was free and open. And writers like E.M. Forster went to the Arab countries because there they could live openly and freely as gay men.
Oh, wow.
Which they couldn't do in Victorian England. And look where we are now. Yeah, so you have to kind of think about these things.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's extraordinary. Oh, that's...
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Blown my mind. What makes you laugh, Yasmin?
What makes me laugh? My husband's the funniest man I've ever known. He does make me laugh a lot. I'm not sure. I'm always telling him, you know, he laughs at people falling down and things like that. He's always on his looking. I don't find all of that funny. I find real wit funny. I mean, people like Ned Sherrin, Corran, what was his name first?
Alan Corran.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. I mean, that British humour, I absolutely love it. Have I Got News for You? Will Have Me Rolling Around. When I was younger, I used to love all the Carry On films. You know, Ugandans loved the Carry On films. We really loved them. But now I don't find them so funny. Yeah, wit more than straight jokes. The comedians I find fun. I used to love Linda Smith and Jeremy Hardy.
Oh, God rest both their souls. Yeah. No, I was lucky enough to work with both of them. So I
they were good. What funny programs do I watch now? Frankie and Grace, which has got Jane Fonda that fantastic her name's escapes me. Anyway, two actresses in their later years looking and just making you laugh every minute. I'm hooked on it. So whenever I've had a hard day or I'm down, that's where I'll go. It's great.
That's interesting because you go, whenever you've had a hard day, that's where you go. Where you go is to humour. You also said that your husband makes you laugh. That's kind of, isn't the whole Humorology project is about seeing what makes us so attractive to other people, whether that's in a business sense or in a personal sense. Why do you think that we are so drawn to people who amuse us? What is it about the human psyche?
It must be very sort of deep in what it means to be human. I don't know if animals laugh. I don't know that. But
there are some animals that laugh.
But you know, this idea of a shared humor, certainly I think it, you know, Indian movies, which I used to, and I mean, Shakespeare saw that in the most tragic of plays, he'll bring in the clowns as if to make it bearable, almost the light and shade, you have to have the clowns, even in the deepest tragedy. I think in Indian movies, it was the same. You always had, in the old Indian movies, whatever was going on, there were these comic characters that would be injected, sometimes willy-nilly, into the plot. But to lift the spirits of the audience, and those were quite unforgettable movies. It's like there is a need to release whatever. It's almost like a valve, isn't it?
When it's done properly, it's laughter is registering shock, really, and that is the release. And so that enormous release comes with the shock. I was interested that you mentioned Shakespeare, because you and the great Maya Angelou said your first white love was Shakespeare. So did you fall in love with that Shakespeare humour as well as the dramatic nature?
Yes, all of it, all of it. We were made in Uganda to memorise entire plays. And I'm really grateful for that. I'm really grateful because it made me absolutely love and know Shakespeare. And actually, I think about 6-7 years ago, no, longer ago than that, the Royal Shakespeare Company heard how much I loved Shakespeare and asked me to do a one-woman show. And they gave me a fantastic director, and I did 100 shows for them here and abroad. And part of the show was very tragic. It's about my love of Shakespeare, my relationship with my father, and some incredibly funny comic scenes. And all kinds of people came to see it. Emma Thompson, I think, Julius Stevenson, Colin Firth, they all came to see it. And they thought it was an extraordinary piece of theatre. But they all said, God, those funny scenes you did when I acted my teacher, Mr. Bhattacharya, who very disapproved of Romeo and Juliet, because it encouraged the young to fall in love. And so he would do these lessons saying, now, girls and boys, think about that. What happened to them, to Romeo and Juliet? Silly children. What happened? They died. Shakespeare, very clever man, he kills them to show you love is not allowed. You die. I did this on stage. Stage. Proudest thing of my life, actually, that was.
Do you think that everyone can be funny, or is it a gift given to the few?
I think everyone, like I said, it is what it is to be human. But I think whatever it is, life, experiences, parenting, kind of beats it out of you, or doesn't allow it to flower. And it's really interesting seeing my three grandchildren. The youngest one is going to be a stand-up comedian. I'm sure about that. He's just irrepressible. And the oldest boy is so serious. So serious. And just wants to win. Wants to win everything. And I often want him to lighten up and kind of take life a little bit more lightly and find things funny. And the youngest one thinks everything's a laugh. Just so interesting.
It is interesting, which is why I asked the question. If there is, you know, a comedy gene, a humorous gene that flows through people and just comes out in certain people, because I think everyone can learn to be funnier. But I'm not sure everyone hears the rhythm of how to be funny.
Yes. Well, it's an instinct, isn't it? It's an instinct. Yes. Somebody says something and you just think, it comes out almost before you think about it, if you've got that facility.
And if you've got that facility, I think you, through your life, through circumstances, you know, you give pleasure to people by creating it.
I have to tell you this because it's a very, very funny moment. So a few years ago when Boris Johnson was Foreign Secretary, I think, and we were all going to go on to the Andrew Neil show, and we were in the chairs outside at the studios in Milbank, and another sex scandal had just broken with him, you know how many. And there were all these people, or ministers, and I said to him, Mr. Johnson, I'm really upset with you. And he said, knew me because we'd been on a couple of foreign trips and things. He said, yeah, well, what? And I said, I'm the only woman, it seems, who's not been asked by you to have an affair with you. And I'm incredibly upset. And I said it the very straight way. Everybody fell about. And he went red with anger. He was not pleased. He was really not pleased. He didn't laugh along with it.
Well, but isn't that interesting that also he didn't want a woman to be funnier than him, perhaps?
Yes.
You know, so we go back to our earlier point about that's, you know, seen as his place.
Yes.
To be the amusing one.
It's one of my proudest moments.
Well, it's a great, great put down. I love it. So what would the world be like without humor?
Well, there are places, aren't there? I mean, there's underground humor in a lot of in countries where repression is terrible. But you know, somebody was telling me, who is an asylum seeker from Eritrea, who got in touch with me, because a lot of refugees get in touch with me. And he said when he was in the cells in Eritrea is hell on earth, like Yemen is as well. He said the one thing he noticed, nobody laughed.
Wow.
And I've always thought, you know, Nelson Mandela in prison for all those years, he always said they laughed. They kept their spirits up by laughing at, you know, the system. And this guy from Eritrea said, nobody laughs. Isn't that tragic?
That is tragic. And it's indicative, isn't it, of a broken society.
And you know,
Donald Trump had no sense of humour.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Isn't that interesting? There was nothing that came out of his mouth that was funny or witty. And it told you something about the guy's psychology, I think.
Yeah, whereas Barack Obama, he could have chosen to be a stand-up. You know, he had all the skills to be able to do that.
I was born without any fear
of position, right? So I can laugh at the Queen and I can laugh at anyone who's got power, because to me, they're the same as anyone else. I don't believe in the hierarchy of human beings. I don't believe some people are born to be, you know, given such respect that we may not laugh at them. And if you are a believer in equality, then you absolutely should be able to bring down or laugh at everyone, including yourself. So whenever I make fun of the royal family and the people who worship the royal family, people get very angry, saying they're the royal family. And I say, so what? They're as human as you or me, you know? As my mother used to say, just imagine them sitting on the toilet. And then you won't be scared
of them. I don't really want
to
be honest with you.
But it is very important that equality and humour are connected.
So do you think there's something, because obviously your book is Ladies Who Punch, do you think there's something about punching up being okay, but punching down not being okay, because that becomes bullying.
Yes. But, you know, even so, I think, what I remember before, during the awful Brexit years, I used to go and meet with readers
who all wanted to have an argument with me.
And I'd go to places I don't normally go to outside London. And we'd meet in a pub or a cafe, and they'd have a real go. And then after about an hour, we would all be laughing and talking together. And they'd inevitably say at the end of it, I didn't know you were like this.
Do you think that laughter is actually the lifeblood of any good relationship?
Yes. 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 Absolutely. How do you live with somebody without laughing with them?
It's true, yeah. Isn't it? But that's true on the macro and the micro, isn't it? So you were talking about Eritrea and nobody laughing, or in a flat in, you know, Scunthorpe. If there's no laughter in that microcosm of society or whole society, it makes things very hard.
Yes.
Or impossible.
And when laughter dies, I think the society is dying. I really do. Like I said, you know, in Idi Amin's time, Ugandans still laughed. But Eritreans are not laughing today in those cells that they're kept in, which I find... I wonder what Terry Waite and the others, did they laugh when they were there? I must look it up. Because it was
an absolute
shocking period of time of incarceration. Mm. And I wonder if laughter helped them.
Now, this is an interesting question for me because I ask it of quite a lot of guests and I'm very interested to hear your answer. That have you ever taken a joke too far or crossed the line?
No, I'm very politically correct. I'm very committed to PC. I even wrote a book in defense of political correctness because I do think words matter. So, no, I don't think I might, you know, I must have over the years hurt somebody by laughing, but I can't honestly recall. And if I did, I just don't think people have the right to make any old joke.
Well, no, it's interesting. And I actually recommend everybody to read In Defense of Political Correctness because, you know, now racism, sexism, homophobia, you know, xenophobia seem now to be proudly expressed in the world. And there seems to be a movement, you know, probably Steve Bannon started it, of like people holding it up as a badge of pride.
Yep, and yet they're the same people who are so sensitive when it comes to their politics and their side of the divide. You know, they give it, but they can't take it. So I often feel, you know, the same people who say, let's have freedom of speech, our country's being destroyed, blah, blah, blah. They want us to repeat their platitudes. They want us not to laugh at them. I mean, you know, I would love to sit Dominic Cummings down in a room and have five comedians laugh at him by making jokes about him. I bet he would find that intolerable. Takes himself far too seriously. I think in a way, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't laugh as much as he should.
But we've got to the point in the show now, Yasmin, which we like to call quick fire questions.
Quick fire questions.
Who's the funniest business person that you've met?
I had a very good friend
who sadly died a couple of years ago, a Ugandan Asian called Moise Vasanji, and he was very funny. He was an extraordinarily successful businessman, but he had the most brilliant sense of humor. And he'd have us laughing all the time. And he used to call me his little socialist. And he'd invite me to dinner with all his multimillionaire friends, saying, I have a little socialist for you at the table. So he was so successful. He was one of the, totally transformed Jordan's, the cereal company, from sinking to becoming. But he was very good.
Oh, great.
And his workers loved him.
Well, that's a sign of a good leader. I think that leadership involves a lot of laughter, to be honest with you, if you want to get people on your side. What book makes you laugh?
How to Be an Alien. Have you ever read this?
I do, because I'm half Hungarian. But well, it's George Mikesh.
I love it. I still frequently go back to it. It's just so funny.
English don't have sex.
They have a hot water bottle. It's so accurate. So, yeah, it's one of my favourites.
That is so bizarre, because I was brought up with that book in the house because my father was a Hungarian refugee. I don't know if you knew that. But
no.
And everybody used to call it George Mikes, especially as in America. And
it's Mikesh,
actually George
isn't it?
Mikesh, yeah. And my father was, because my father, when he came to this country in 56, after the uprising, he had to escape. My father, when he came to England, couldn't believe how people behaved. Because he used to walk up to people and go, "Hello, my name's Laszlo. How much do you earn?" And he used to say that Ashen, people used to go, it's like they'd been stabbed through the heart with a bread knife. It was like, because nobody ever said, but and the good thing about my father is that he knew, because he was Hungarian, how to tease and how to play, which when he arrived in Britain, that everybody, you were talking about people being buttoned up, was very buttoned up. And so women all loved my father because he would just say nice things to them. That shirt really suits you. That's a beautiful outfit. And nobody ever said this stuff, you know. And so he was very popular with the ladies, including my girlfriends as I was growing up. Anyway, it's an aside. What film makes you laugh?
I mean, I do think Richard Curtis films, I adore them.
Four Weddings.
Four Weddings, which we watch every year because our daughter's crazy about them.
Notting Hill.
Notting Hill. I love Notting Hill. I just think it's gentle humour. And I like that a lot. I don't find these kind of some of these American comedies, you know, The Airplane and all that. They're very witty. The script is fantastic. They're not warm, whereas the Richard Curtis does warm comedy, and I love that.
Ah, lovely. Ah. So we've touched upon it already, but what is not funny?
Anything that disregards the inequalities of influence and power and money and picks on those who are disempowered, which is what was so wrong with the Jimmy Carr joke. You know, gypsies are amongst the most persecuted people in Europe. And it's not funny when you pick on them. So I think it's always being aware that there are some people who are still living impossibly difficult lives, and to laugh at their expense. I think it's different if they're laughing with you. But if you're laughing at them, that's not on for me.
What word makes you laugh, Yasmin?
What word makes me laugh? Boris. How did this happen? This man with such a name. You know, I wouldn't buy a melon from him in a market. And he's here. So that word makes me laugh.
Well, I wouldn't buy a melon from him in a market. I just love that phrase. It's like, what sound makes you laugh?
Sounds. Oh, I love the sounds of little children and babies. I mean, I will always break out into a smile or a laugh. I think there's something so compelling when you see a little or hear a little child laughing in that way that they do.
It's wonderful. It is my favourite sound as well. You went to Oxford. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
Probably clever.
Yeah?
Probably clever.
Why?
If I'm honest. Because it's very hard for someone like me to end up in a place like that. And you have to be smart. And I like the fact that I got there and got out alive. It was a horrible place. So, yes, I don't want to be fun. I am funny, but I am smart. I like to think I'm smart because nothing was given to me ever in life. Nothing.
Wonderful. And finally, Yasmin, desert island gags. You can only take one joke with you to a desert island. What is that joke?
I love the limericks. One of the limericks that have been produced as we speak on Prince Andrew. I think they would have me, the grand old Duke of York. All these new very witty things would make me laugh. I think that would be it at the moment. Currently, I'm laughing at Prince Andrew. And he really does make me laugh.
There's no actual joke that you'd like to
actual
end
jokes?
With?
I'm not into actual jokes. I'd only know one, and it's not very good.
Oh, well, tell us it anyway.
Okay, hang on, let me think. Okay, how did Batman call Robin for to come in and eat? Dinner, 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 Batman! Not good.
No, but it did make me laugh, and I can imagine your grandchildren loving
yes.
that.
I think I got it the wrong way around. So Robin calling Batman. Dinner, 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 Batman!
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And you've been wonderful and enlightening. Thank you so much for being a guest on
the
Humorology Podcast.
Thank you, Paul. It's been such fun.
The Humorology Podcast was hosted by Paul Barros. Produced by David Rose. Music by Steve Hayworth. Creative direction by Les Hughes. And additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.